you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. This is the beginning of the TechNet. TechNet number 1536. About the series that began 32 years ago, 1982 in September. You'll also be hearing John, KC2WGB, who handles the mailbag. And he looks on the computer at Echo Link and IRLP. If people have trouble signing in, he'll know about it. You'll also hear Paul into, here we go, WS2N, Paul, who gives us the report on what the National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. From time to time, you'll also hear Hal, K6DPZ, who has a lot of radio experience. Let me drop it. Main purpose of the TechNet is education. We amateurs gather the clan each Sunday night, 8 o'clock, for the last 32 years, and we teach each other wireless techniques, the ins and outs of ham radio. There are 26 different kinds of ham radio. The one you're listening to right now, 2-meter FM by way of a repeater, it's just one of the 26 kinds. Arguably, ham radio is one of the most educational hobbies you can ever get involved in. The schools that teach wireless engineering and radio engineering, by my standards, do a slightly less than mediocre job. They're stuck in the paradigm, they're stuck in the methods of educating that subject that were developed back in 1947, and they've changed very little ever since, most of the schools. So the material they give you is not necessarily useful engineering information. You can't walk out of a good school, in most cases, with a Bachelor of Electrical Engineering degree in your hand, with a specialization in radio communications, and go out and hire yourself as a radio engineer or as a antenna designer in particular. Let me drop. The thing that amazes me the most is that all of radio, when you're studying radio transmitters, radio receivers, transmission lines, Smith chart, all of radio has the only purpose of sending a signal through air. Nobody would bother putting your voice or data information on an RF carrier if you weren't going to be transmitting that RF carrier through the air. If you just if you want to transmit data, there's lots of ways of transmitting data that don't require RF modulation. So once you accept the fact that you're going to use RF modulation, you're going to be sending a radio signal through the air. You can't get that radio signal through the air without a transmitting antenna and a receiving antenna. So arguably the most important component of a radio circuit is the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna. On many of the radio courses given in many of the colleges, the subject of antenna and antenna design is barely mentioned. You want to get an antenna engineer, you better hire a ham radio operator. Those are the guys who have been tinkering with antennas on their towers, in their backyards, on the top of the roofs of the houses, whatever. They've been tinkering with antennas, they've been comparing notes with each other as to what antenna works better in the situation. How many dollars? Let me drop it. When it comes to the antenna, how many dollars? How many pounds of aluminum or steel? How many square foot of wind load? How much antenna gain? How much front-to-back ratio? What side lobe levels? What bandwidth? What standing wave ratio? All of that is antenna design parameters that are, in many cases, not even mentioned in some of the good electrical engineering schools. The ham radio operators discuss that with each other essentially every single day. So as I said, you want an antenna designer, you want a radio man, more than half the time you have no choice but to hire a ham radio operator. Places like this particular TechNet is where those ham radio operators trade information back and forth, trade information, learning each other, teaching each other how all this stuff works. Because some of it is not common sense, some of it's a little bit magic. That radio signal, once you create it and transmit it, goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe, and I'm not kidding. It goes everywhere, even inside of that shielded can, even inside that shielded room. It's weaker when it gets there, but it gets there. The signal never goes to zero. It goes everywhere. And it does it by a million paths at once, multipath. Every possible path that radio signal will take every single time. It has no choice. It takes every possible path. And what you receive at the other end is a function of all of those individual paths, of all those individual signals, all being added together with amplitude and phase being considered. You're adding up a bunch of vectors. Let me drop. something that's called Rayleigh fading statistics, because some of those paths are slightly shifting because of atmospheric effects, or the waving of a tree, or the movement of an antenna, an azimuth, elevation, location, whatever. Maybe one of them's on a vehicle, and so you're going to get picket sensing effects. But the signal goes everywhere. And whether or not you can receive that signal at the new location is only a function of how well you have set up that path, how high is the transmitting antenna gain, how high is the transmitting antenna, how high is the receiving antenna, what's the receiving antenna gain, what's the sensitivity of the receiver you're using, and what's the limit in sensitivity? There is no limit. If you transmit the right kind of information slow enough, you can always make the signal weaker and still receive that signal. You look into what happens with the Voyager spacecraft, which is now 120 astronomical units. 3 times the distance to Pluto is where Voyager is right now. It's a little QRP transmitter, probably running something like 10 watts of output, 8 billion miles away. And NASA can communicate with that anytime they want to, but there's a catch. The radio signal at the speed of light takes 17 hours one way to get to Voyager. So you say, hey, Voyager, how you doing? 17 hours later, Voyager gets that signal, and Voyager says, hey, everything's fine out here. I'm seeing such and such. Another 17 hours, 34 hours round trip, you get the signal back at Goldstone. Who the heck would ever think the most distant object mankind has ever created, let me drop it, that Voyager 8 spacecraft, with that traveling wave tube running since 1977, I think is when it was launched, and here we are, what, 30, 40 years later, that same traveling wave tube is still talking to us from 8 billion miles away. Who would ever have thought that? So that's a pretty strong piece of evidence that you transmit that radio signal, it goes everywhere. You can't stop it from doing that. If you've got questions and answers with reference to radio, you're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the TechNet. A typical sign-in might sound like this, WS2N, Paul, and yes. So do we have any check-ins tonight? Give me your call letters and name right now, K2LAW.
K2 Bravo Mike Papa, Joe, requesting to make an announcement.
K2YDT, yes.
UPS Mobile, yes.
WS2N, Paul, with a space report.
Okay, we've heard Joe, Eric, Matt, and Mr. K2UPS. My mind's going blank. We'll eventually figure out John's name. Alrighty. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW. KK4, Uniform Zebra Golf, John. We got you, John. Okay, one last call. Anyone else? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW listening.
KC2SHO, Mount Vernon, New Jersey. No.
Okay, Mount Vernon, New Jersey with a no. We only have to check in if you got a yes. Alrighty. The first guy who signed in was Joe. K2B blank P. I didn't write down the call letters, but you know who you are. You got it, Joe. K2RIW in the TechNet. We're listening.
Thank you very much, Dick. Just an announcement, a reminder that Limark will be running a general license class. This is a instructor-led, web-based class for anybody wishing to upgrade to the general class. And it starts on January 20th. For more information, or if you're interested in any way, just email me at whiskey2bravomikepapa@limark.org. Thanks very much, Dick.
Good information, Joe. Joe, while you're at it, since it's only 1 week away, why don't you give us a few words about Ham Radio University, which 1 week from today takes place at Briarcliff College. K2BMP, K2LAW.
Well, if you haven't been to Ham Radio University, you're really missing out on something. They have a gigantic myriad of classes. We have keynote speakers. There'll be licensing classes, more information on licensing classes, a bunch of clubs would be there. It isn't a ham fest, so there isn't any emergency, you know, there isn't any equipment there for sale, but we do have AR preparedness. Let me let it drop. It covers everything from mesh networks to transmitter hunting to QRP, my favorite, to antenna modeling, advanced antenna design. It's just a worthwhile experience, and everybody should go. Whiskey 2 Bravo Mike Papa, back to you, Dick.
Pretty fine, Joe. It's about time I get you cold in his right. Whiskey 2 Bravo Mike Papa. I gave you almost every possible prefix other than that. Alrighty, that ham radio university, I've gone to that quite a few times, and it's worthwhile. Lots of good information there, and lots of eyeballs with these guys you've been talking to all this time, and you find out what they really look like. And some of them really are tall, blonde, blue-eyed guys. Not all of them. Very few. Very fine, Joe. That's something to look forward to. And I think it starts at 7:30 in the morning. I guess that's for the people... I think the general check-in is closer to 9 o'clock, but what is the check-in time for Ham Radio University next Sunday, Joe? W2 Baker Mike Papa, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Doors open at 7:30 a.m., and the first classes start at 9 o'clock, or the first conferences. If you're interested in any of the conferences, a copy of it is on the Limark website, and I suggest you get there early, because there is limited seating for some of these that are very, very popular, and you need to register. So my suggestion is get there early. As soon as you get in there, sign up for the conference that you want. And if you want need a VE session, let them know there. But again, doors open at 7:30. Our first conferences or classes start at 9 a.m.
Good information, Joe. And more of that you can read at the Limark website, which is L-I-M-A-R-C, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, limarc.org. You go to that website, and you'll get all this great information. Thank you, Joe. Next person who signed in was Eric, KE2EJ. And he's the man who maintains all this equipment for us. He's also the chief engineer of Channel 13 and Channel 21 television channels on Long Island, digital television channels. KE2EJ, what's the latest with you, Eric? K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2J. No, I just really wanted to borrow your ears, so to speak. I've made some changes, and what I'm looking for is a critique of audio and quality, and you know, things like hum, FM radio stations in the background, and things of that nature. So what I'm really asking you to do is listen for me and tell me what you hear. I know we used to have a really rising hum, and we'll see what you have to say about it. K2RIW, K2J.
Pretty fine, Eric. While you were transmitting, I listened to the input frequency and heard you, listened to the output on 85, listened to the output link on 147.375, and look at the listened to the input link. There was nothing because you had transmitting there. And so your audio quality direct and your other audio quality through this repeater are almost identical. Same volume, same speech quality, same passband. When I listen to 375, I hear a tiny bit of clicking noise, which we all know is due to some of the local digital equipment. And I hear a little bit less high frequencies on that link. In other words, when I listen to 375, your speech, which on the 85 machine goes out to 3.5 kc, on the 375 machine, I think it stops at around 2 kc. So there's a little bit of a high frequency muffling. Good audio, good speech quality, and good amplitude on the 375 machine, but a slight bit more muffled. The highs are not quite as strong. That's my report, Eric. And that's sounding awful good. KE2J, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2J. Well, I wasn't asking to listen to 375. That's next on the list to change. No, but the thing that I was after is that the echo link problems, the other problems that we were having, those are all gone. I completely reworked the audio path. So it's actually nice and clean. I'll even put a Deutschen analyzer on it to minimize some of that. The 375 lack of high end is really a 2 kilohertz deviation. You don't get as much bandwidth. It's a little tighter. There's no compounding. Actually, I was thinking about doing what we do in the broadcast world, DTX samples, and see what happens. It might actually be fun. Anyway, thank you for your input. As we go along, the link is next. We're going to move that. We're going to change the frequency of that and move it out of the band that's just so problematic. I move, 100 feet in a different direction, and the problems start to diminish, but unfortunately, there's not much that I can do about the antennas that are making the noise, which is right next to us, and then, of course, the other building. All those wonderful 900 megahertz phones. KQRW, KQ10.
Okay, so the radio link that goes out to the Eastern machine, the 147.375, you say is only using 2.5 KC of deviation, and that's part of the reason why the high frequency notes are was prevalent, for very good reason. With only 2.5 KC of deviation, you whistle into the mic at 2.5 KC, you're going to try to create a sideband plus or minus 2.5 KC, just for the first sideband. And the second sideband is going to be 5 KC away. That's the normal Bessel function of FM modulation and what you see on a spectrum analyzer. So I am guessing the particular radio frequency region used for that link has an FCC requirement for 2.5 KC. And that's why it's not running wider than that. Is that that's a guess on my part. Am I close, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW.
Now, as far as the fans are concerned, that's a bad guess. As far as the commercial world is concerned, which is where the gear came from, that's an absolute fact. So, the gear, though, I mean, actually, if I used something that was wider, the noises and stuff would be worse. But, it just so happens that that's the gear that I got my hands on, which was the commercial gear. Actually, the interesting part for me was that the gear is, synthesized on both sides. Now, in the commercial band, there's 36 megahertz between transmit and receive, which don't work out too well for us in our part of the band. So, we've got to move them. VCOs don't really like to move, so I just designed new ones.
Yeah, I thought the lowest to the highest frequency in that band was 28 megs wide. I didn't know it was 36. And I know that the new FCC mandate is that all new commercial two-way radio equipment will have 2.5 KC of deviation. The more narrow band channels, they think they're going to squeeze twice as many in there and get some kind of economy out of that. It's very naive. It's going to take them 10 years to find out that it's probably a bad decision. Equipment-wise, and I guess because of the IF bandwidth of that equipment, you wouldn't be able to just increase the deviation. You'd be walking out of the IF strip. That mandate of the FCC, I am guessing it has already come about. In other words, all equipment as of some date earlier than this, all new equipment must be 2.5 KC deviation, as opposed to the old 5.5. Roughly when did that mandate come about? And is it retroactive? In other words, is there a grandfather clause that allows you to keep using older, wider band equipment for a period of time? Or was there a date set by the FCC beyond which new or old equipment all must be 2.5 KC? KE2EJ, KQRIW, the TechNet.
KQRIW, KE2EJ. Well, my expertise is not in, what is it, 97? My expertise is more in the broadcast region, but yes, there is a definite hard cutoff date, and as people move and they start occupying what was part of another frequency, if you get somebody doing wideband stuff, they're going to be stepping on them. So yeah, there's a hard cutoff date. I don't know exactly what it is. I know it's rapidly approaching, and it has approached for some services. but the 900 megahertz radio is a part of its tracking system. That's always been my 2.5 kilohertz deviation. But don't forget, there's really an ulterior motive here. And that is, as they canalize the 2.5 kilohertz spacing, really 5 kilohertz spacing, you can stuff a nice digital signal into that spot. And you can put one right next to it, and they don't bother each other.
So I think you're saying there really is some good engineering here, that it's not just a bad decision. Audio-wise, I think a 2.5 KC deviation FM system is going to have a huge amount of squelch noise every time the carrier drops, unless you've got some kind of a peel tone that stops transmitting before you let up the mic, if you know what I mean, or before the carrier drops. And the fidelity is definitely less at 2.5 KC. So by way of the digital capability, of a co-channel capability, I think you're saying that the decision might actually be a good one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, I don't know if you've actually listened to any of the digital stuff. But it's pretty miserable, actually. You know, people swear by Moto Turbo on USB deviation, but they use a slightly different codec and a slightly different scheme, and it sounds a bit better. And it's amazing what you can do with. I mean, essentially, you've got 9600 baud worth of space to do something in it. And that's not only transmit the audio, it's transmit the identifier, it's only the crap that goes with it. From that point of view, and taking the digital standard of the codec that you use into consideration, that could be a good thing, even though I don't like it. I mean, what have I got to say about it?
Yeah, the word digital audio, something that I'm becoming a little bit skeptical about. By way of digitizing the audio that's sent over many cell phone circuits, they do have certain advantages of bandwidth, signal-to-noise ratio, and whatever. However, the method of encoding the digital audio at times is rather robot-like. In other words, there are times when the method of digitizing the audio sent over a cell phone is such that you might not be able to recognize the voice of your father, your mother, your son, your daughter, your wife. You may not be able to recognize them because it becomes so artificial. I was at a meeting of a club Friday night in which a man at the restaurant table was using his cell phone in the speaker mode with the cell phone laying on the table. And we're talking to a good buddy of ours in Texas, who normally joins us for these meetings, but he wasn't able to. He was in a restaurant using his cell phone in the speaker mode. He was talking, we were talking, and you could hear the speech going back and forth. But because of the distortion of the audio, because of the speakerphone effects, you could only understand 50% of the words. So we got a ways to go when it comes to the quality of the audio that comes out of some of our modern cell phones. And when a person is buying a cell phone, there's all kinds of things he checks on, that which service should he buy, what's the price of the cell phone, what goodies does it have, what applications can he add to it. Rarely is the purchaser of the cell phone smart enough up front to ask, what kind of fidelity am I going to get out of the audio? What kind of life am I going to get out of the battery? Can I carry a spare battery in my pocket so I can switch it? Is the battery a replaceable item? Can I charge the cell phone at the same time I'm using the earphone output? Is it all one common connector? I mean, there's a bunch of practical questions a person buying a cell phone should ask. I hear lots of people complaining about what they bought downrange because they didn't ask those questions up front. Maybe you've got some opinions on this one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, there's a couple of different things that we could talk about here. One is, as far as like the audio quality of the cell phone, they all use a 80 BPM. A compounded vocal cord modeled type of compression system. Basically, capable of creating artificial sound as much as it is carrying sound that it has encoded. The reason for that it really to occupy as little space as possible so you can get more people talking at the same time within a certain amount of bandwidth. So, I mean, there you kind of stop. Whereas it gives you reasonable quality if you've got, you know, if you've got a low error rate, you know, if the BGR, your connection to your transmitter is really low, it really doesn't sound bad. Start introducing errors into it, and it tries to recalculate what the numbers that it's supposed to be receiving are. That's when it starts to sound a little funny, and the worst the signal is getting to the phone, the lousier it sounds. As far as, you know, today's cell phones and technology changes by the 6 months to a year period of time. Let me drop. Whereas, you know, the questions of how long does my cell phone last, you know, my phone today, the new one, will give you many, many hours of continuous transmitting, continuous talking. I actually can go for 2 days without charging my cell phone with moderate use. But you ain't replacing the battery in that. When it comes to the new battery technology, you know, it's advanced from what we originally called lithium ion to these lithium polymer type of batteries that are amazing in structure and that hold as much energy as they do. And it's truly amazing that we don't have too many people's pockets going on fire. That's a whole other story. So yeah, as far as like, yeah, you can talk while your headphones connected, all the questions that you asked today of today's cell phones is not equivocal yet. There are some differences between the data services like Verizon. You can only use one type of service at a time, whereas if you want to do data while you're talking, you can. Whereas if you've got AT&T or T-Mobile, you want to talk and sit and that at the same time, no problem. There are differences between different manufacturers. But there's a lot of commonalities between the way all cell phones work, so that's why the codec is kind of universal. So, KQIWK2J.
I'm guessing that if the cell phone is up against your head, the fidelity you hear is medium good. But when you try to take the tiny little speaker inside and use it as a speaker phone, laying it on the table and, you know, five people at once want to hear and talk in a round table, so to speak, at each end, then the audio starts getting kind of yucky, particularly if you're in a noisy restaurant and you're going to turn the audio up loud. And there are some cell phones with all kinds of fancy applications inside, which are current hogs. And there are some people with a cell phone in full use, only lasts for a couple of hours. My son, Christopher, KP2IQN, insists on buying a bare-bones cell phone with minimum capabilities, let me drop, in which case with a modern day lithium polymer battery, he's able to get 3 or 4 days of operation before he has to recharge it. So that's his philosophy. And these lithium polymer batteries, they do have extremely high energy density, but they got some nasty failure modes. If they get overcharged, over discharged, or get punctured, almost all of the modern day lithium polymer battery chunks of electronics have a protection circuit in between the battery and the rest of the electronics, making sure you can't overcharge or over-discharge. So that electronic protection circuit is what's making lithium polymer have such good track record with so little fires in the pocket, so to speak. I do remember at one of the companies I was working at, a couple of years ago, a whole rack full of lithium polymer batteries were being charged simultaneously. But one of those batteries went haywire for some reason, and the gas, it gave out. Maybe the company was being ultra-conservative, but they evacuated the building for a couple of hours until they corrected that outgassing battery. What would you for any other comments on this one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
As I told you many, many times, there's that little boy that comes with every battery to do just that. Going back to the original lithium ion batteries, and even some of the nickel metal hydride batteries had the regulator boards built in. But I heard a funny story about there's a guy that has, you know, a regular old flip phone. goes into the store, we must buy another battery for it. And the kid says to him, what's that? The phone, what's that? Like, you know, he didn't even recognize it. The thing must have been like, you know, 7 or 8 years old. And that's just so how rapidly the technology changes. So, the reality of digital audio, and they're getting back to that, if you want to have, like, high fidelity, you need some bandwidth. Gotta be able to, you know, move that across to the sample rate just high enough so it doesn't sound like digital garbage. I mean, you've got guys like, Crosby, Stills, and Nash. They're pushing this thing called a dodo. It's sampled at 192 kilohertz. It's actually standard AES rate, but 24 bits wide, and they're calling that better audio quality than the CD, which is, I mean, the studio today only beginning to sample at 96 kilohertz. The 192 kilohertz make a little bit of difference. You ain't stepping that through the entire cell phone band, so that's the state of the world. K2RW, K2K.
One last question, Eric, that I should know and I don't know. And that is, we found out by way of Superstorm Sandy that a hell of a lot of people had dead cell phones because they didn't know that probably the most reliable source of power is the cigarette lighter on their automobile, a 12-volt battery in that automobile, with rare exception, it's always there. Whether Leica, Con Ed, or anybody else has their difficulties. And a significant number of those people didn't have the power cord, didn't know where it was, didn't know it existed. So my question is, when I buy a modern-day cell phone, does it come equipped with the cigarette lighter charger cable, or do I have to buy that as an accessory if I'm smart enough to know how to ask for it? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
No, two things. K2RW, KE2EJ. One, when you buy a cell phone, it comes with nothing. It comes with a battery, and maybe if you're lucky, it comes with a headphone with a microphone in it. Like an iPhone comes with earbuds. And a charger. That's it. You want to do anything extra, you know, ka-ching. Send them some money. The other thing is that even if you did have a charger for a lot of the cell sites, and I mean a lot of them, for the first day or two, you can have a fully charged phone and get nothing. It took a while to get generators at a lot of the sites that had no generators. So, K2RW, K2J.
By way of the disaster of Superstorm Sandy, and so darn many cell sites went down for significant lengths of time, and cell phones were not easily charged. So, have there, to your knowledge, been some rule changes by which a higher percentage of the cell sites are now required by law, probably FCC law, to have standby power so that when their backup battery system fails in 2 hours, 4 hours, whatever it is, that there will be a generator on site? And I think there were some rules also saying that a significant number of gas stations must have standby power, so they're able to pump gas in a lack of Con Ed and LIPA power. So have there been some rule changes, and for the next Superstorm Sandy, when it occurs, will we be equally as bad off, or will we be a little bit better off this time, you think, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
QGZ.
Yeah, you got that other station in a second. Well, I'm not the expert in this particular area. As far as I know, from talking to guys that do maintain the cell site, they get past the FCC rules of their battery banks, but I said, as far as they go, the rest of it is all financial, whether or not they're at a site like, well, they look for a site like what I have, where I have generators, and they buy power from me, and I sell them power. I also guarantee them that they're going to get locally generated power when the power goes out, but that's not every cell site. And also, it depends upon the company. Some companies do it, and even at the same site, other companies don't. So, you know, it's all a matter of bucks. But as far as the rules are concerned, I'm not the one to ask. I'm not up on it. It's not in my field of vision, because, you know,
not the business that I'm in.
HLIW, KHSJ.
Okay, we're about to get the answer from a man who's on the front line. WB2QGZ, Bill, to my knowledge, for the last 10 or 15 years, has been keeping a whole lot of different brand names of cell sites in full operation, despite some pretty weird modes of failure. So what's the latest on standby power at cell sites these days, Bill? WB2QGZ, the microwave voice of Massapequa, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, I know there was some talk down at the FCC about trying to mandate generators or some minimum amount of backup power. I don't think it went anywhere, and there's a couple of other issues with that. It's not as simple as, you know, the cell phone folks decide they want to put a generator in. Changes, trying to wrangle changes to some of these, first of all, to leases, which is really actually, that's probably the easiest of a change at a site for ground space, but the zoning. I did work at a place where we tried to aggressively put generators in a lot of places after that blackout in 2003, I think August, something like that, and zoning was almost impossible. It probably 70% as difficult as zoning a new cell site, trying to get a building permit to put a generator in, particularly on a building, even with a cooperative landlord, Lou Drop. And the other issue with backup power is, you know, I've worked at places that have had a lot and places that haven't had so much. The bulk of my failures, though, have always been Verizon's backhaul. Now, that may be a little bit different now, as a lot of people are using Ethernet backhaul and alternate vendors. I know that in the place I'm at now, we provide power to the interface device at the cell site. So the good news is, as long as the other end is up and all of the interim active devices are powered up, we'll be okay. But specifically with Sandy, not only was a whole lot of fiber muxes had no backup power to begin with, but the cabinets were flooded, and when those cabinets were reinstalled, they were mounted 6 or 8 feet off the ground, whereas before they sat on the ground. So there's a whole other big bank of infrastructure that needs to be backed up to make the cell phone work outside of just the cell site.
From what you're saying, I can see that at the backhaul, the interconnect between the cell sites and the landlines, if that fails, you're in a heap of trouble. And so I'd like you, from what you're telling me, some improvements have taken place in the backhaul system, elevating above the ground and better backup power. A typical cell site, though, has battery backup before the generator kicks in. And that battery backup, what's your guess, Bill? Is it good for 2 hours, 4 hours? The batteries at a typical cell site, if you had a run on batteries and it happens to be on the top of a building, that particular cell site, and the landlord wouldn't let you put in a generator with the standby gas or oil to keep it running, therefore you're dependent on those batteries. And so modern day cell sites, those batteries are good for roughly how many hours, Bill? WB2QGZ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Well, it kind of depends. It depends on the philosophy, like Eric said, the philosophy of the company, the size of their wallet, the physical space you have. I mean, some places, even within individual companies, some places will have more backup than others because of ground space available or space in cabinets, stuff like that. I would say most places should have a minimum of 2 hours, worst case. And, I have places we built that had 8 to 10 hours and places that had less than 6 hours. When you look at some of the large area outdoor DAS networks, we have the telephone pole mounted cell sites, which all go back by fiber to one big location. That one big up, but the actual node itself, the other end of the fiber is dark, you know. So it really depends on the company and the individual situation. How's that?
Yeah, Eric recognized. I can see that it's quite variable. From what you told me, it sounds to me like most cell sites are good for 2 hours of battery backup, and a few of them go as long as 8 hours, but not a great deal longer than that is the impression I'm getting. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out in the broadcast world, we essentially biked off 5 minutes and we light it myself. Although, depending upon the mileage, you may have to re-inject more light into the 5 minutes. Now, remember, I sent you a whole bunch of stuff on how that happened. But in the case of the cell sites, like the sites at our place, it's really a hunk of 5 minutes goes to the switch. In my case, the switch is actually a hunk of where the CO is. There's, you know, one solid piece of fiber with a couple of breaks here and there, but that's not the situation in the heavy cell site. A lot of cell sites have small C1 Wi-Fi links. I mean, they're transferring a lot of sites from simple C1 to wider bandwidth fiber, so a lot of that is changing. But I just wanted to point that out. K2RWK2, yeah.
Give me a number here, Eric. If you in your broadcast industry buy a piece of dark fiber, that means the fiber is installed, but there's no transmitter or receiver on either end. You supply that. Your organization supplies that. So if you're supplying the transmitter and receiver optical on each end of a dark piece of fiber, in which case that piece of fiber is good for how many miles before you're essentially forced into putting in a intermediate amplifier? Can you go 10 miles? Can you go 50 miles? How many miles can you go on a piece of fiber before you have to have reamplification? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
It all depends whether you're using single mode, multi-mode, multiple frequencies. It can be anywhere from 20 miles to like 70 miles, and more, depending upon whether it's a single frequency light source. It comes out of the laser diode, of various different sizes. But in the broadcast world, we had our own terminal gear at one time because we were actually sending analog video over it, or we could have been sending the contents of an entire satellite that's in the sky coming down a dish, you know, all 24 transponders and 48 transponders, depending on how your pad is set up. And we're actually moving towards using just plain old Cisco switches at each end, using the standard stuff. So you can order a gig line between here and there, and you know, you're also saving money. So there's a lot of tricks that are going on, and as we move towards some of the cheaper stuff, like the traditional IT world, then you start having to go through other people's gear, and you're prone to more points of failure. But then again, the biggest point of failure with the phone company is when they happen to mistakenly pull out the patch in their patch bay, which has your signal going to it. K2RIW, K2J.
And do you have a built-in test module that'll light up a light on an instrument panel somewhere telling somebody, hey, that thing that just got yanked, it's located at this address, that's the phone number. Get on that phone right now and shout at that guy. Have you anticipated that kind of a failure, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW?
No, most broadcast gear has alarm contacts. What you do with them is up to you. But typically for most broadcast organizations, there's a Rolodex which has the phone number of the supplier, whether it's the Verizon or Broadcom, or what we used to call local radio, or Civics, or many other various, even Time Warner. They are providers, and like that, they're providers of fiber circuits. So you need to know what circuit number went down, and then you'll need to call up that number, and then they will yell at someone.
When that kind of a failure occurs, does that give you an outage of a minute, 10 minutes, half an hour? On a typical outage of that kind, where there's a human error involved, you got to get on the phone and shout at somebody, What's the minimum length of time you've ever had that kind of a failure, or the maximum length of time? Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
Now, if you happen to be lucky enough to have your failure on Thanksgiving Day or Christmas Day, it may be waiting a day or two. Typically, you know, it can be a couple hours, but if you're a broadcaster and you don't have a backup line for whatever you're doing, you shouldn't be in the broadcasting business.
So I think you're saying that even in the event of that kind of a failure of a link of what you're now broadcasting, or I am guessing in many cases, the link is used for sending the data from point A to point B. You put it on a hard drive, and at some later time, you play that hard drive and a backup hard drive for actual over-the-air transmission. So I am guessing the link itself is quite often these days not used live. It's used for transferring the data onto the hard drive that's going to then be broadcast. Bunch of guesses on my part. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, KE2EJ. Well, I would like to agree with you, but I can't. And I'll tell you why. Watch NBC in New York. You're actually watching this video originate from Atlanta, Georgia. And it's getting up to NBC in New York by a couple fiber circuits. We're going to do live from Vienna, which is very good. And that's a combination of fiber in Europe. It goes up to satellite, comes down in Maine, goes up to satellite again, and it also goes to the fiber circuit through various different points, down to Washington, goes to New York. And there are multiple paths, just one of them fail. So, you know, we still, actually what we do is we use something called an edge service, which will actually take a future show and they actually send it at slow speed to a service somewhere to build up, or sometimes we'll have a gig e-circuit available, and we'll do it at 4 times real time, getting the stuff down, because when you think about it, one HD signal is 1.64 gigabits per second, and when you start adding that up in seconds, it's a lot of gigabits. K2RIWK2J.
That's a lot of hard drive capacity. Yeah, I guess when it comes to something like New Year's night celebration, and if I think I understand what you're saying, is that you have a live channel sending that from, say, Vienna, Austria, or some other place in Europe by way of those satellites and other links. So in that case, it's not a pre-canned piece of information. It's live data as it happens. Is that correct? And I know you said a European city. I remember it as Vienna, but maybe I remembered it wrong. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Yeah, that was the case of live from Vienna. We go from Vienna, Austria, through fiber circuits to, actually, the BBC in London. From there, it goes to an uplink facility. Also goes somewhere in France and goes to another uplink facility and comes across on 2 completely different satellites. Comes down in Maine and a couple of different diversity sites, so that way if you've got bad weather in one place, you still got another place to pick it up, and it's not a problem. And then that goes to its various distribution points. But my other point was, is when you're watching Channel 7 or Channel 4 or Channel 2, well, Channel 2 is coming from New York, but Channel 4 and Channel 7 don't originate out of New York. Channel 4 originates out of, I believe it's Atlanta, Georgia. I think they come out of Crawford, actually. And they feed via fiber to all their network stations. So that fiber feed is live all the time, even though it may be a pre-recorded program. Get the idea?
Yes, I do. When it comes to a New Year's Eve celebration, if this is the best of all worlds, it'd be nice to see midnight approach in each one of the time zones in sequence all the way across Europe and then even across the United States. My guess is there isn't quite that much interest for seeing a New Year's Eve celebration that many times in a row. But I wonder, in the broadcast world, does anyone else try to cover each one of the time zones 1 hour at a time? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Now, if you go back into the neurons of your brain, you can think back to the year 2000. when the year 2000 glitch was supposed to happen. That's a joint venture between PBS, ABC, BBC, NHK, I can't even remember all the players. We did exactly that, and it was simultaneously broadcast all over the world. So, Dick, got a question on something that you brought up?
Rich recognized. So, I think you're saying in the year 2000, they did do that. But since the year 2000, I presume every hour on the hour is no longer in demand. Just a couple of those hours, is that what we're going to be getting this coming Thursday night, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Well, if you tune into your three, actually your four-bit major networks, you will be seeing it from New York and Los Angeles, maybe Chicago. What they actually do is they have events in each one of the big cities all over the place. So they do the ball dropping in New York, and they do all the parties in Los Angeles. So that's the extent of it. But that's commercial television. When it was the change of the century, you know, that was the bright idea of the folks at public television, and the other folks joined in. So, you know, that was a one-of-a-kind event that happened once in a century.
I'm guessing you were very busy that night lining up all that equipment for PBS. Is that true, Eric?
Tried 3 months in advance. That was quite a bit of work. I mean, we were a control center, ABC, and the office a control center. There were a number of different control centers. It's amazing the number of circuits that were being fed all around the world.
Very fine, Eric. Rich, N2EO, go right ahead with your question on this subject. K2RIW, the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, a few minutes ago you were talking about cell sites and the ability to keep them running in a superstorm like Sandy. I wanted to know, I see on lampposts, I see these boxes that are square boxes with antennas hanging down vertically. Are those cell sites or are they something else?
The local cell sites.
Yeah. Are those so-called microcell sites, Eric? Give us a few words on those, between cell sites, mini-cell sites, microcell sites, sometimes cell sites within buildings. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Now, this is really a question of it to the AMB, but, the microcell sites, they're those little fill-in areas where, like, inside my building that we had in New York, what we put together is, I actually ran MADIACs through the place and put the bidirectional amplifiers on an antenna that was pointed at a cell site. So, there's a lot of little tricks you can do to fill in the blanks, and that's what those things are.
Yeah, I think by way of those bidirectional amplifiers, you can take a multi-story building, even that has a couple of subfloors below a grade, and you can irrigate the building with RF energy that eventually all comes together to one major antenna on the roof that aims at a cell site. And therefore, in the building where you would normally have a lot of cell phone dropouts, if the building owner has done a good job, then the person literally can sit in the stall in the bathroom behind a metal partition and continue his conversation if that's what he wants to do. I bet you Bill's got a couple of words on this one. WB2QGZ, if you're there. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, we use radiacs everywhere, so everything was covered.
Let's see what Bill's got to say on this. Have you been installing radiacs in buildings sometimes, Bill?
WB2QGZ, yep. We have used radiacs here and there. Usually these days, I've used a transmission line that we actually would penetrate the shield, which was rigid aluminum, and actually just thread an antenna into it. That's one way to do it. So you basically thread a quarter wave with a collar right into the transmission line and have it touch the center conductor. But usually, so you have a couple solutions. One of them, if it's a lot of traffic, remember, if it's going to serve a lot of people in a big building, directional couplers, you know, at drops throughout the building. That's the way I've done most of the bigger buildings. The intermediate buildings and large homes, like I did a 58,000 square foot house out east for somebody, we use a device that just takes your existing Fios or Optimum backhaul, plugs in, derives its own timing from there, and it is capable of handover and a full-featured cell site sort of stuff that you know, just operates at home, and it's a small little panel device, so I'm going to let drop. And finally, the lowest end of that, the consumer end, you know, not a lot of people use BDAs. You can, it's a quick solution at home if you can buy it and plug it in and it doesn't blow up, but I'm sort of the interference guy where I am, so a lot of my day is spent finding BDAs that are oscillating to themselves, and that actually makes it typically worse for you at home anyhow. A lot of carriers will provide a device that allows you to, some of them have a little GPS receiver, and you got to stick them near the window or something. Some of them rely on network timing, but it'll give you some sort of usable phone carrier, you know, voice carrier up in your house. Some carriers do have boxes that make LTE as well, so they'll do kind of wideband LTE, give you halfway decent over the air data speed. But a lot of phones, a lot of carriers allow you to do Wi-Fi calling. So with a medium-featured handset, a lot of places will let you turn the Wi-Fi calling on. So if you have a Wi-Fi hotspot in your house, you can process incoming and outgoing calls right through your hotspot. So you can have coverage, you know, wherever you want. If you're a dead spot in the basement, but your router covers down there, you're good to go.
So by Wi-Fi techniques and buying the right service, you can have rather good coverage throughout your house. Now, as a ham radio operator, where I know that altitude of the antenna makes a big difference, if I had a cell site that is, let me pick a number, 4 miles from me, so that certain rooms in my house I have marginal coverage to my cell phone, and if I was willing to put a very simple antenna, could be a coat hanger wire antenna, on the roof with a piece of BNC cable coming down inside the house, and then some kind of an antenna inside the house, and all I have to do is hold the cell phone near that antenna. And now the cell phone in my hand is effectively transmitting and receiving in a passive manner to that antenna on the roof that has good coverage. I, as a ham radio operator, would think about doing that. Is that out of the question, Bill? Is that ridiculous? Or is that something that a smarter guy might consider doing without buying extra services if he happens to be a frugal guy? It would be B2QGZ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
I've done that. That works.
Sounds good, Eric. And Bill, how many people have done that? Have you considered it? Over to you, Bill.
B2QGZ, Jim. I have not used that in a while, but I have done that on a couple of improvised locations for folks or for short-term things, a couple of tunnel projects. With you know, below grade stuff, where we just set a Yagi to a local cell site and put a quarter wave down inside the construction area, and you had to go stand near it, but it got a phone to work, you know, 70, 80, 90 feet to below grade. And I've done that in some basements for folks as well. Where I used it was at 800 megahertz on the Sprint, Nextel Sprint to Iden stuff. I haven't really used it anyplace else, but it does work, you know, so there's no reason, as long as you have sufficient signal, that it shouldn't work at 1800 or 7800 megahertz for either PCS or AWS channels. The thing you gotta watch out for, though, is if you don't have a distinct server, in other words, you have an Omni up on the roof as opposed to a directional antenna looking at, you know, one cell or another with decent signal, you know, now you have a